The second case set for argument this morning is Appeal Number 30748, Kevin Rowe versus Dion Rowe. Andrew Damgaard is here representing Mr. Rowe, will be arguing, and Aiden Getzinger is present, who will be arguing on behalf of Ms. Rowe. I might just, before we start, recognize Judge Eric Kelderman from the Seventh Circuit, who is sitting with us this morning in place of Justice Salter, and we appreciate Judge Kelderman's participation with the court this morning. The other comment I'll make, I'm not sure, but I think there might at some point in time during maybe toward the end of the argument, there's some sort of a national emergency management alarm that may go off. So if you hear an alarm, just ignore it. We'll keep going. And right, Shirley?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. With that, then, Mr. Damgaard, you can proceed with your argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, opposing counsel, I notice the halls of the third floor of this building are currently empty, but for 9 weeks every year they're full. And they're not just full of lawmakers. They're full of everyday citizens. They're full of activists. They're full of people representing business interests. They're full of people representing religious organizations, even people representing other state agencies. And all of them generally have two goals, influencing government action or influencing government inaction. And they don't take the rest of the year off. They go home, they write letters, they engage in advertising campaigns, they attend meetings at every level of government, tribal, local, state, and federal. And then they go to the courts to seek to enforce their rights. In South Dakota, we have a statute that provides people with immunity to engage in that behavior. In jurisdictions that don't have a similar statute, people are given immunity under what's known as the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine. And that provides immunity to people from suits based upon those people exercising their First Amendment right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It happens to be the same clause in the First Amendment that makes access to courts a fundamental right. That immunity has been expanded both by this court under our statute and by the federal courts under Knorr-Pennington beyond legislative and judicial proceedings. It's been expanded to the proceedings of government agencies, government boards, and government subordinates. And the purpose behind both Knorr-Pennington and our statute is to encourage people to participate in government and communicate freely with government without fear of being sued for it. Because the theory is subjecting someone's motivations for participating in government to scrutiny would discourage them from doing so.
So your argument in your brief, you I think a couple of times you use the term immunity. This is a privilege statute. Do you see a distinction between the statutory language, communication is privileged, versus the idea of immunity?
Well, I think this court has held that when a privilege is absolute, it's the functional equivalent of immunity. It just means that you're not subject to being sued for the underlying conduct. And that I think that's the Breck case, which involved the circuit court judge who was sued for comments he made during a criminal sentencing. So I think the court has been clear that when it's an absolute privilege, it's not actionable, so it is the functional equivalent of an immunity.
But if it's based on conduct or language outside that privilege, there's no immunity.
Correct. If it doesn't fall within the privilege, then it would be actionable, right? But to the extent it does, the party would be immune. It's undisputed in this case that Kevin and Dion Rowe were married for a number of years, then went through a contentious divorce. That Kevin leased land from the Rosebud Sioux tribe that was directly adjacent to Dion's family farm. Dion preferred that if Kevin was going to lease land, that he do it somewhere other than adjacent to her family farm, so she wrote a letter to the Tribal Land Enterprise, which is a subordinate of the Rosebud Sioux tribe. It's charged with managing all of Rosebud's tribal lands, and she asked the TLE to consider rescinding her ex-husband's leases on the land adjacent to her family farm. The TLE considered that request at one of its regularly scheduled meetings and ultimately rescinded Kevin's leases. Now, it's my position that those are the only undisputed facts necessary to determine that the privilege applies. We have a request for government action that's considered within the ordinary course at a regularly held meeting. In fact, this court has held that a complaint to an administrative agency where no action was ultimately taken was absolutely privileged.
Can you speak about the nature of the TLE, whether or not this is an official proceeding?
Sure. So the Indian Reorganization Act, I think was in 1934, gave tribes the ability to create public corporations to help them govern. States had been doing so for years, as this court's well aware. I think most of the cities in this state are municipal corporations. At one time, I don't know if this is still the case, at one time townships, school boards were public corporations. So Congress gave the tribes the ability to do that, and then Rosebud, sometime thereafter, amended his constitution to provide for the tribal land enterprise and give them authority over all their lands. At all times, the Rosebud tribal president has to sit on the TLE as well. So they derive their authority both from Congress and the tribe itself. It's a subordinate of the Rosebud Sioux tribe, just like our public corporations are subordinates of the state, our cities, our school boards, and our counties, things of that nature.
Is there any sort of a requirement as to what sort of things are needed in a hearing to make it an official proceeding?
I think what this court has held, they just have to be vested with some power, you know, some legislative power, be vested by the legislature. I think there's been 10 cases that I found that have dealt with the absolute privilege. 8 of them have held that it was absolute and the case wasn't actionable. The 2 where they were deemed not privileged, this court made clear that they dealt with entities that had not been vested with power by the legislature. So,
I understand that, but I think it's case law that says that it needs to resemble judicial and legislative proceedings. Do you agree with that?
I do, yeah. Right. And,
and here, what happened was, how did this resemble judicial and legislative proceedings? That's what I'm wondering.
Well, it's been extended also to administrative proceedings, or even proceedings of, you know, professional boards, so long as they're vested with power to act by the legislature. Clearly, the TLE, you know, whether you describe its function as judicial or legislative or quasi-judicial, I mean, the bottom line is the TLE was vested with the authority to act by both Congress and the tribe. They had the authority to hold those meetings. They hold regular meetings, and they determine, you know, all the rights and all the leases with respect to tribal land.
Fair enough. But wouldn't there also be, when it comes to quasi-judicial or legislative proceedings, wouldn't some sort of notice or ability to respond or even just hearing about what's happening with regard to specifically Mr. Rowe's lease, wasn't he entitled to some sort of notice before they took action? And wouldn't that be something that would be indicative of judicial or legislative proceedings?
Well, I think that's where the trial court actually erred. Is that the trial court conflated the action, the propriety of the action, with the authority to act. They're two different things. And the text of our statute, you know, binds the privilege to an official action authorized by law, not the propriety of that action. In other words, it doesn't hinge on whether the decision maker made the correct decision, only if they had the authority to act. And clearly, the TLE, even if it did violate one of its lease policies, which is what the circuit court found after looking at the lease policies on the internet, that would just go to the propriety of the action. And presumably, there's a remedy for that. State court, you know, and federal court, we have appellate review. That's our remedy. Here, the TLE's actions had to be authorized, signed off on by the BIA. And the record's not really clear what action Mr. Rowe took, if any.
Thank you.
Towards that remedy. I didn't cite the Norr Pennington cases because, you know, this is a state court case. We have a statute. We have very, I think, clear decisional law from this court. So there really wasn't a need to. In fact, I thought it was interesting because we've had our statute and it predates Norr Pennington. I've only found one decision where this court has ever referenced Norr Pennington. But if you do look at the cases from the various federal circuits, you will find it comes up quite a bit in the context of government contracts, because on the federal level, there's a lot of money involved in government contracts. We'll have individuals that are promoting themselves or disparaging their competitors to try and procure a government contract. When a case arises out of that, the federal courts hold that it's not tortious. It's not tortious to try and influence the government. And they do that under Norr Pennington. The one case in which this court did reference Nora Pennington was the Hobart case, which dealt with a circuit court that actually enjoined a party from making complaints to government agencies. This court reversed the grant of that injunction, held that it was unconstitutional, and actually quoted the U.S. Supreme Court as stating, quote, "It is neither unusual nor illegal for people to seek action on laws in the hope that they may bring about an advantage to themselves and a disadvantage to their competitors." As a result, this court has held, in that context and in the context of the absolute privilege, that the motivations for petitioning the government are irrelevant. So is the truth or falsity of the statements. Now, whether you want to label this a constitutional or a statutory issue, or to say that the First Amendment gives citizens the right to petition the government, our state statute ensures that they can't be sued when they exercise that right. I mean, what this really comes down to is a policy and a value judgment. And our policymakers have believed for a long time, because I believe there's a variation of this statute when we were a territory. The current version of the statute, I think, was passed in 1939. But our policymakers believe that there's more to be gained by people communicating freely and participating in government, and that that outweighs individuals' rights to be free from interference in their business relationships or damage to their individual reputation. So we would ask that the circuit court's decision be reversed, unless there's any other additional questions.
Well, on your public policy argument, you've basically argued that citizens will be hesitant to bring their complaints to governing boards, bodies controlled by the statute. But here, we've got a tortious interference claim. And that requires that the interference be intentional and through improper means or for an improper purpose. Wouldn't those elements protect a citizen bringing an issue in good faith?
No, I think they'd still be subject to suit, because the element that we'd be dealing with here, absent the privilege, the element we'd be dealing with is justification, whether it was justified, and this court's held that that's a fact issue. So they would be subject to suit and have to go through with that. But because we have the privilege, they're immune. And what the federal courts would say under Nora Pennington is that when they're exercising their First Amendment right, it's justified as a matter of law, even though ordinarily that's a fact question.
Let me ask you about that, and this may come up in the argument from the other side, but there's this issue with the you didn't plead the privilege statute as an affirmative defense. Let's assume we determine it is an affirmative defense, has to be pled in the answer. Where's that place you? I know you didn't move to amend. What's your status in terms of, can you raise a defense? Was it there? It was. That's what you guys were arguing about, but it wasn't pled. So what's your view of that?
Right. Well, I don't think it is an affirmative defense, but if it were, if this court were to hold this an affirmative defense, there wouldn't be any prejudice at all to Kevin. It was purely a legal issue. He didn't dispute any material facts. He had the opportunity to respond to the summary judgment motion. He did, in fact, respond, filed his own cross motion, and he didn't avail himself of Rule 56F, which this court does have decisional law that, you have to avail yourself of Rule 56F to claim prejudice. With respect to the affirmative defense, there's a number of reasons it's not. The first is this court has already implicitly, on two occasions, held that it's not, and I say implicitly, but if you look at the Breck case, which was a circuit court judge, the Janklow case, which was then a special prosecutor, later attorney general, and governor, both those cases were appeals from the circuit court dismissing the complaint for failure to state a claim. That wouldn't have been possible if privilege were an affirmative defense, because, as this court knows, motions to dismiss for failure to state a claim come before the answer. So there wouldn't have been an answer, there wouldn't have been an affirmative defense to consider, but yet in both of those cases, this court unanimously affirmed the circuit court's dismissal for failure to state a claim as a matter of law, holding that it's apparent by the complaint that this is not actionable.
Well, but that's allowed under a pre-answer motion rule. You can raise a defense as a motion to dismiss. Here we had an answer, and then we're dealing with summary judgment, right? So we got a different situation here.
We are, but most of the courts that hold that it is an affirmative defense say it's not available for a motion to dismiss, that they have to answer, plead the affirmative defense, move for judgment on the pleadings. I'd also say that the ability to dismiss it for failure to state a claim is consistent with what this court has said the purpose of immunity is, which is that people not only be free from the litigation process, but the fear of being subjected to litigation. And if that's the purpose of immunity, it makes all the sense in the world that somebody would have the opportunity to get out of that case at the earliest possible time. Because the more the case proceeds, the more the purpose of the immunity is undermined. The other reason it's not an affirmative defense is in South Dakota, the burden's on the plaintiff to prove an unprivileged communication, and that's statutory. It's an element of the plaintiff's case. Now, this isn't a defamation case, but this court has expanded that privilege to all other torts that are based upon a communication. It would make sense that if they're going to expand the privilege, they would expand the burden as well. I also think making an affirmative defense would shift, obviously, the burden then onto the defendant. I think that unnecessarily implicates First Amendment issues. It's been a long time since I've read New York Times and its progeny with the United States Supreme Court, but I do recall that the burden's never on the speaker. The burden's always on the plaintiff.
So if it's if we deem it to be an unpled affirmative defense, is it tried by implied consent then?
It was, and like I said, they had no prejudice because they were able to respond to it, did respond to it, didn't make a 56F motion, made their own motion. The other reason I think it's not an affirmative defense is the fact that it's purely a legal issue. And I would know of no other instance in a legal issue where the court's time and resources would be at the mercy of the pleader. I think we provided some case law from other jurisdictions that have held that even on appeal, where it wasn't raised down below, the appellate court says, wait a minute, this case isn't actionable. I mean, we're not going to force courts to preside over actions that aren't actionable. So those are the reasons I think it's not an affirmative defense. The extent this court holds that it is, like I said, I don't think there's any prejudice towards Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Gatzinger, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Aiden Gatzinger, and I represent the appellee, Kevin Rowe. There are two issues pending before the court today. The first is whether the statutory privilege to defamatory communications under SDCL 2011-5 sub 2 applies to the letter written and sent by Dion to the TLE Board of Directors. The second issue, by Kevin's notice of review, is whether that statutory privilege is required to be pled as an affirmative defense to a claim for tortious interference in South Dakota. It's important to consider what the statutory privilege we're talking about today is. It's a definition for what privilege is in the defamation chapter of Title 20, and it states that communications are privileged if they're made in any judicial proceeding, legislative proceeding, or other proceeding authorized by law. As to the first issue, the statutory privilege does not apply to Dion's letter to the TLE for three reasons. First is her letter had no connection or logical relation to the TLE's purpose. Second, this court has never applied the privilege to claims for tortious interference, and it shouldn't do so in this case. And third, the TLE Board of Directors meeting is not an official proceeding authorized by law.
Did you make that argument to the circuit court about the fact that the absolute privilege has never been applied to an intentional interference with a contract claim?
Your Honor, it's hard for me to recall specifically if that argument was made. We certainly made the argument that this was not an official proceeding and that it had no...
question about that, but did you make the argument that this is a separate claim, this isn't defamation, this is a separate tort claim, it doesn't apply to that? Was that argument made to the circuit court?
I don't believe that argument was... I can't recall if that argument was specifically made to the circuit court, but I do believe it's properly before the court today in consideration... because there is a policy reason for why the court should consider whether this should apply to tortious interference claims when it's statutorily authorized to apply to defamation claims. Now, the court has extended the privilege on occasion to other torts, but again, it's important to consider that this is in Title 20 on the defamation chapter. It's a definition for what a privileged communication is, and that's because the elements of defamation generally are that it's an unprivileged statement and it's false. So it would make sense that the legislature then defines what is a privileged communication. This court has extended, like I said, the statutory privilege to other torts, and it did so most recently in the Gantbort case, which was in 2022, where this court extended the privilege to a claim for invasion of privacy. And the reason this court did so is because it said defamation and invasion of privacy are the same in all respects with regard to application of the privilege. But tortious interference and this case are distinguishable from the Gantbort case and from the claims of defamation and tortious interference.
So assuming it's not waived, what facts would remain if we take the letter out and determine it's privileged, absolutely privileged under the statute, what facts would remain that would provide Mr. Rowe a claim or cause of action for intentional interference with a contract?
If the court decides that this is absolutely privileged,
yeah.
I don't believe he would have a claim because it's based on the act of her sending this letter to the TLE. So I don't believe...
So the letter is the sole basis for the claim and that communication to the TLE.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason that it's distinguishable from a claim for defamation or intentional invasion of privacy is because the damages that are sought between the two claims are significantly different. In defamation claims and intentional invasion of privacy claims, the plaintiffs are seeking damage to reputation that are caused by the publication. Contrast that here, Kevin is seeking a direct damage to an economic interest that he had with the TLE that was a direct result of the letter that Dion sent to the TLE Board of Directors, and that was an intentional act.
That's a question of damages, not question of is Dion liable for that communication she made to the TLE. That's a separate analysis, isn't it?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. The reason that I'm arguing that why the damages are distinguishable is why the court should not extend the privilege to claims for tortious interference, because it is significantly different than a claim for defamation, which involves reputational damages. Now, you might have cases where you have a reputational damage that causes an indirect economic interest, and I would concede that that might be privileged, but that's not what we have here. We have a direct action by Dion with the design of interfering with Kevin's leases with the TLE, and she succeeded in that respect.
But isn't the whole purpose of the privilege to protect the type of communication? And how is this type of communication, which I think you're alleging is essentially defamed your client before this board, different than those other types of tort cases?
I think it's different because you have that direct connection between the agency or governmental actor involved and the communication. So here, the TLE was the market participant, and that's who she made the communication to. Whereas where this has applied in, for example, the Gantbort case, it was statements made in a judicial proceeding. So let's say for purposes, if Dion had made these statements in her divorce proceeding and they had some logical connection to the divorce proceeding, and those then made their way to the TLE, causing the TLE to cancel the leases, yes, I think that would be privileged under this statute. The distinguishing factor here is you don't have that intermediate layer of the judicial proceeding. You have direct communications to the contract holder, the TLE, with Kevin's leases with the TLE. And even more so, if this court were to say that this statutory privilege can apply to claims for tortious interference, it doesn't apply in this specific instance. And that's because her letter to the TLE had no connection or logical relation to the TLE's purpose. In Flugy versus Wagner, cited by the parties in the briefs, this court laid out the elements of the privilege in the official proceedings context. And there are four elements. The first is that the publication must be made in the proceeding, or the communication made in the proceeding, must have some connection or logical relation to the proceeding. It must be made to achieve the objects of the proceeding, and it must involve litigants or other participants.
So are you arguing all four of those are not established here, or which ones are you disputing?
Primarily number two, but also number one and number four. But with regard to number two, the reason I start there is because in Janklow versus Keller, this court held that special emphasis must be placed on that second element, that the communication has to have some connection or logical relation to the proceeding.
Well, isn't there a task to manage all tribal land? And so isn't this about the management of a tribal lease?
In the very abstract, that's of course what Dion would like this court to believe, but I don't think it is. I'd invite the court to look at the letter itself, which is found at record page 331 and starting at page 2 of Dion's appendix. In the letter, Dion makes allegations about Kevin that he uses drugs, he uses alcohol, he's threatened their daughter's animals. He and Dion and her mother are fearful of Kevin. Kevin is violent, he's attempted to lure her onto TLE lands, and she doesn't want to be near Kevin. And with that, she ends by saying, oh, by the way, please rescind his leases for those reasons.
But isn't the relevance of that information the justification for her request to change the leases?
I think that is correct, Your Honor. However, the TLE's purpose found at record page 205, the TLE's bylaws, is one, to remedy the increasing fractionation of ownership interests in allotted lands on the tribe, and two, with regard to this with land management, it's to utilize lands under the control of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe to further economic development purposes. It's not a purpose of the TLE to manage social and interpersonal relationships and interactions between ex-spouses, and that's what Dion is asking the TLE to do.
But doesn't that go to the merit of her request? And you might be absolutely right. Maybe this was improper, what they did, in conjunction with the reasons that were set forth. But I don't know that we've ever evaluated whether something was an absolute privilege based on the merits of what was said. But there's certainly a connection to what she was asking them to do and what they had the authority to do, right?
Your Honor, I wouldn't concede that there is a connection. And whether this is about the merits, I think, is unrelated to this question, because what the court needs to consider is, in the context of this entire letter, is it related to the TLE's purpose? Yes, generally, the TLE is authorized to administer and manage tribal lands under its control, but it has to do so for the purpose of economic development of the tribe. And these complaints that she's making are completely about social interactions with Kevin, have nothing to do with economic benefit to the tribe. For example, her letter doesn't state that she or her daughters are willing to pay more for the leases than Kevin is. That would ostensibly further the goal of economic development for the tribe. It has nothing to do with Kevin overgrazing the land that he's leasing from the TLE. It has nothing to do with Kevin failing to maintain fence lines. It has nothing to do with Kevin otherwise not caring or being a good custodian of the leased lands. Those would be purposes that the TLE can consider, because that does go to economic development.
But the whole reason she sends a letter is she says, I'm looking for a remedy. Yeah, it may be relational, but I'm looking for a remedy for you to fix this by terminating the lease and then leasing it to my daughters instead, so this guy's not coming across my land to farm the land that he leases from you. So isn't that the remedy she's seeking? That's the whole purpose of the letter. She's not bringing it to them to say, issue a, yeah, I guess that'd be privilege too, if you issue a protection order, but she's coming to say, hey, fix these leases. This is causing a problem for me personally, this lease. And that's exactly what the TLE is responsible to do.
The TLE is responsible to manage and utilize the lands and administer leases, but it's in conjunction with that purpose in the TLE bylaws for economic development purposes. This has nothing to do with economic development for the tribe. It's all about her personal relationships with Kevin. And I would invite the court, as it did in Janklow versus Keller, to view this letter in its entire context and not just on that last line asking to rescind the leases. That alone should not be enough to demonstrate a connection or logical relation. In Janklow, this court rejected the plaintiff's request to consider just one line in the removal petition, and instead said we have to look at the removal petition in its entirety to determine whether there's a connection or logical relation. Here, Dion's asking the court just to look at the one line saying, I'm asking you to rescind his leases, and ignore the rest of the letter that has nothing to do with the TLE's purpose. And further, even if the court does believe that there is some connection or logical relation, the court still has to find that this communication was made in a proceeding. So I'd ask the court to recall that Dion wrote this letter unsolicited and sent it to the TLE on April 16th, 2022. There's no record evidence that there was any TLE Board of Directors meeting scheduled at that time, let alone any Board of Directors meeting scheduled to consider Kevin's leases. And it wasn't until about 3 months later, on June 14th of 2022, that the TLE Board of Directors actually met to consider this letter and voted to rescind Kevin's leases. So it's our position that there was no proceeding when she wrote this letter. So she can't meet that first element either. And finally, under the fourth element in Pflugi, this court said that the communication has to involve litigants and other participants authorized by law. It's never really been defined what that means in the other official proceedings context. However, I would submit that Kevin is not a participant authorized by law in this. This goes to the circuit court's rationale of Kevin had no notice that his leases were under consideration. And this is distinguishable from the case of Pflugi, where we were dealing with complaints to the State Board of Accountancy, because that board is authorized and designed to govern and police accountants within the state of South Dakota. So they are necessarily participants to proceedings. And there's also procedures that are statutorily authorized to govern the initiation of proceedings before the Board of Accountancy. And there is no such procedure in the TLE's bylaws to initiate such a proceeding. So Kevin was not a participant to this proceeding. He was not a litigant. So I don't think that Dion can meet the first, second, or fourth element. And so this is not, so she cannot prove that the purpose apply or the privilege applies to the letter that she wrote to the TLE and sent to the TLE.
How do you respond to Mr. Damgaard's argument that you are conflating the propriety of the action with the authority to act?
So, Your Honor, I think it's just, my argument is a little bit more nuanced than that. I'm not necessarily saying that the circuit court had the correct reasoning in its decision, but the circuit court did come to the correct rationale or the correct decision ultimately. And in Harris and many other cases, this court has held that it can affirm a circuit court's decision on summary judgment for any reason, not just the reasons laid out by the circuit court. So I think that Mr. Damgaard has a good argument that you shouldn't have to rely on the propriety of the proceeding, but you still should have some procedures in place to make it an official proceeding. And that's not what we have here. And this is why the TLE Board of Directors is not an official proceeding. As Judge Kelderman noted, an official proceeding is that which resembles legislative or judicial proceedings, such as transactions of administrative boards or quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative functions. This court is only...
Is this not an administrative board? Because we've certainly extended it to administrative functions, administrative boards, as long as they're under the authority of a legislative body. And no question, in this case, they're under the authority. The TLE is under the authority of a sovereign body. You don't have any dispute about that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why is this not an administrative proceeding?
So I think the distinction here comes by distinguishing the two cases where the court has extended the privilege in the official proceedings context, and that was in the Flugie case that I previously mentioned, and then the Bloat case. And in those cases, we had communications made before the State Board of Accountancy and in an unemployment compensation hearing within the Department of Labor. And in Pavlovich, cited by us in our brief, the court noted that a reason that those are official proceedings is because those are authorized by statute to engage in factual determinations, investigations, and make final decisions. And again, those entities or boards also had procedures to initiate such a proceeding by complaint or by petition. Contrast that with what the TLE does. Its bylaws do not provide it with any fact-finding or investigative authority. The bylaws provide that all decisions by the TLE are subject to review or are just, as a matter of course, reviewed by the BIA superintendent. So they don't have final decision-making authority like the entities that involved in the two cases where the court has extended the privilege. And further, again, the bylaws do not provide any procedure for which to initiate a proceeding by a complaint or by a petition. And in two cases, this court has refused to extend the statutory privilege in the official proceedings context, and that was in the Walm case. I see I ran out of time, Your Honor. May I briefly conclude?
Go ahead.
In the Walm case, this court refused to extend the privilege to statements made before the State Brand Commission, which was an arm of the South Dakota Stock Growers Association, which in turn was an agent of the State Brand Board, which was statutorily authorized. This case is closer to the State Brand Commission and Walm, which did have a decision-making authority, than it is to the two entities involved in Flugie and Bloaty. For those reasons, we'd ask the court affirm the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Damgaard.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court has been clear for well over 50 years that if it's absolute privilege, it's not actionable under any theory, under any tort. If we look at Janklow, the deceit claim, dismissed because it was absolutely privileged. We look at Gantfort, which is this court's most recent decision. Privilege required dismissal of the invasion of privacy claim. If we look at the Harris case, the privilege required the dismissal of the negligence claim, the negligent infliction claim, and the contribution claim. It's simply not actionable under any theory. I think what opposing counsel is doing is inviting this court to sit in direct review over a tribal agency, which I don't think is proper. I do, however, think that the relationship between neighboring landowners is a legitimate concern of land management. I think that anybody who spent time on a farm or a ranch understands that if the neighbors get along, that's a good thing. There tends to be less cut fence. There tends to be less injured livestock. There tends to be less water diverted and water shut off. So I think it's certainly a legitimate of concern. It was right in their wheelhouse. That's what they do. They manage all the land. To get an idea of how liberal the logical connection standard is, with respect to the proceeding and just how powerful the policy is behind this privilege, I think you look to Janklow. When I look at the communication in that case, I just shake my head. It's one of the only times I see what would otherwise be summary judgment for the plaintiff. We had the criminal defense lawyers in a petition to federal district court say that the state's special prosecutor and a DCI agent were drunk in a bar conspiring to violate the civil rights of the defendant. And when the federal district court judge holds an evidentiary hearing, he finds that the defense lawyers violated Rule 11, didn't even read their petition before they filed it, that they admitted that, you know, it wasn't just a bar, it happened to be the hotel restaurant where they were staying. And the federal judge also found that Mr. Janklow didn't even drink. Federal judge promptly remanded that case back to state court and actually disregarded 100% of the testimony that was in front of the judge because the judge found it totally not credible. But yet the policy behind this privilege is so powerful that this court said it wasn't actionable. I mean, it was clearly defamation, but it wasn't actionable because when we're dealing with defamation, we're dealing with injury and damages to an individual. Government doesn't function well when people are afraid to participate in it. And if they are afraid to participate in it, now we're inflicting damage and injuries on all of us collectively.
So, Mr. Damgaard, when it comes to the argument of the whether this is an administrative agency or board or whatever, the TLE, makes a distinction between adjudicative-type administrative boards and a board that maybe has no adjudicative function. TLE doesn't appear to have adjudicative function. Does that matter?
I don't think it matters.
Why not?
Well, it's been extended to administrative agencies, all kinds of different administrative agencies.
Well, yeah, certainly those administrative agencies in the cases we've extended it are adjudicative-type boards. One was a disciplinary, I think, dentistry board. I don't recall what the other one was, but both adjudicative-type boards.
Yeah, one was, I think, South Dakota Unemployment
Division
for comments made there. You had the Accountancy Board.
So can you create that sort of a distinction in terms of, you know, because we've also talked about it being quasi-judicial, those types of functions. This is a little bit different. I don't think TLE has any kind of adjudicative function that I can see.
No, but the privilege does, by express terms, apply to legislative-type functions, judicial-type functions, which are adjudicative.
Do they have a legislative function, the TLE? Or are they manager of the land?
Well, they're the manager of the land, but they're, as part of their function, they're able to pass their own rules. In fact, one of their own rules was the basis for the circuit court's denial of summary judgment in this case. But it's pretty broad. It covers judicial, legislative, and any other official proceeding authorized by law. I mean, whether it doesn't specify whether it's adjudicative or legislative, it's just any other proceeding. So it's a broad privilege, and this court has held that it's to be liberally applied. And so we'd ask that this court do what it historically has always done, as when there's a communication to a governmental entity that's even tangentially related to that entity's function, the communication is absolutely privileged. We'd ask that the circuit court's decision be reversed and that it be directed to enter summary judgment in Ms. Rowe's favor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess for about 10 minutes.